Welcome to the DevCon Archives, featuring top sessions from the latest DevCon, which took place in Bangkok in November 2024. These episodes spotlight some of the best talks from the largest Ethereum developer conference, showcasing the technical advancements, mission, projects, and novel ideas shaping the Ethereum ecosystem. All talks have been recorded. You can find them on archive.devcon.org. Let's dive into today's featured talk.
Watching on the live stream. My name is Tim, and I'm the founder of Kiwi News, and I will be talking today about demand-based reoccurring fees in practice. So if you're a developer, you might have seen this already, or you might have come across this problem. You have a new side project or something, and you found a name, and you type it into a domain name search, and then what you see is that the domain name is just not there. And then in my case, for example, I looked for kiwinews.com, and there's actually a 500 error, so a 500 status error. So it's actually not even used. And then I looked it up, how much it would cost for me to transition the domain, and it was actually $8,000 one-off fee and $21.99 a year to then rent the domain. And it's kind of annoying because I would love to use the domain. And fun fact, all fourletter.com domains have actually already been taken since 2013. And so in the talk today, I want to give you this promise that we can basically already fix this. We are just not doing it. And you will learn how. And so basically, this is not only a problem in Web 2, it's also a problem already in Web 3. And Vitalik said this in his blog post in 2022, where he basically said that all the 9,000 most popular .eth names that are in the Scrabble word list for the most popular words, they could have been rented for 100 years for the equivalence of 12 Lambos, essentially. And that is because a .eth name essentially costs $5 a year to rent, and so it's actually just not that much to squat these domains. But the problem even transcends kind of the digital space, and it's actually 100 years old, and here you can see this behind me on this photo from 1914, where somebody bought a vacant lot in a city. I think this is in Illinois. It's from a person called Faye Lewis. And I'll read out loud the text on the poster, and then we can talk what is going on here. So the poster basically says, everybody works but the vacant lot. I paid $3,600 for this lot, and I will hold it till I get $6,000. The profit is unearned increment made possible by the presence of this community and enterprise of its people. I take the profit without earning it, and for the remedy, read Henry George. So this is very similar, actually, to the domain names that we just saw that are always being squatted, in that somebody just did it with real estate, right? And if we look top down at inner city real estate property, then what we can see is that the pricing kind of is related not necessarily to the improvements on top of the lots, but it is related to the neighboring properties. So the A1 property here is most likely going to be valued higher than the A2 property, because the A2 property is essentially next to like this garbage processing facility and a factory, whereas the A1 property is in close proximity to a university, a cafe, and so on. And so this really brings us, I think, to one of the core ideas of our talk, which is what is Georgism, or Georgism in general as an idea. And Georgism, kind of how Georgists themselves describe what they're doing, is they say there is first of all land, and land is the source of all wealth in the economy. And so on this land, there are fruits that are growing, but I think more generally speaking, these are not only the literal fruits but also, let's say, like minerals in the earth, the soil, even like the air part of the quote-unquote land, and then even the, you know, the property rights that you can get when you're having, when you have land in a city. And Georgists basically believe that the fruits can be harvested or extracted from the land by putting in labor. And then the fruits are actually the desirable good within the economy. And this is because for that reason, they can be used to generate wealth. And so Georgism really considers labor as the wealth-creating function in the economy. And therefore, Georgists generally believe that taxing labor kind of discourages productive work, because it's just in a way of like extracting more resources and quote-unquote fruits from the land. And so their idea is to tax the land ownership, because that would tax the unearned profits of the land, and it would encourage the productive work on top of the land. And so this is one way of solving the problem, right? Like this would solve this like vacant lot problem, but there are actually more problems in the digital space, because, for example, Kiwi News has this unique property of being only a useful domain to a handful of people, like me, for example, because I'm running such a project, but to another person might not be the case. And so there's this idea of a natural buyer, which is essentially this like one person whose company name is also that domain name, or whose personal name is that domain name. So like we have, for example, Vitalik in the Ethereum community. He is kind of the best known Vitalik out of all of them. And so he's like a natural buyer of that Vitalik.eth domain name. And the same is true for Coinbase. And what Vitalik said also in this ENS post is that essentially if there is only one natural buyer for a project's name, then speculation on top of these domain names might actually not lead to the best possible price, and it might not lead to an efficient market. And we can look at this by analyzing kind of the relationship between seller and buyer. And the seller, so basically on the vertical axis you have the seller at which the price at which the seller is willing to sell the domain, and on the horizontal axis you have the probability of the buyer willing to accept the offer. And then you have this slope that basically describes the willingness of the buyer to buy the domain at a given price. And the seller actually has this idea in their head about about maximizing their expected revenue, right? And so if you plug my preferences into that chart, you can see that on the vertical axis on the top there is this 7,999 price point, which I'm kind of not willing to accept at a very high, I'm willing to accept it at a very low probability. But even at the $3,000, I would only be willing to accept it at a 50% probability, and then the maximized expected price for the seller would be $1,500. What's interesting here is that even at the $3,000 price point, everybody will only get a used kiwinews.com domain at 50% of the time, right? Because there's another 50% where I'm accepting it and another 50% where I'm not accepting it. And so really the core idea here is that of efficiently and inefficiently allocating property. And if we have a property, like on the left-hand side, the domain that is currently not being used and it costs a lot of money, then we call that inefficiently allocated. And then if I would be able to use the website, if I would be able to use the domain for my project, we would call it efficiently allocated. So how do we actually design for efficient allocation then? So this was kind of the motivation for why we should even bother, right? And spoiler alert, it is demand-based reoccurring fees. So we can basically start to model out a solution here by starting out with the existing state and then gradually like improving our solution. So we have like these different pricing models. And if you look to the chart on the left, you can see that on the vertical axis I have cost, which is the red line, and I have demand, which is the blue dotted line. And you can see in the first chart that essentially the cost spikes up initially and then drops to like this $21.99 a year. And note how the cost and the demand are not mapped to each other. So if we have a higher demand, we don't have a higher cost. And this is a problem because it essentially encourages squatting, and it also blocks productive use, as I've just said. Like, so then we could say, okay, if we don't want squatting and we want productive use, we are just going to increase the fee, like increase the reoccurring fee. And that's essentially scenario two, where you can see the demand curve has flattened a little bit, right? It's now a bit closer to the, I think it maps a bit closer to the cost curve. However, here the problem is that we might not be able to anticipate all the valid uses, and so the cost might be too high, too low, and still demand could rise throughout time, right? So really what we want is demand-based reoccurring fees. So and that's the third chart, where essentially demand and cost are mapping between each other. And so in that case, we have an efficient market, we have a fair price for the asset, and most likely we'll have productive use. So these are essentially demand-based reoccurring fees. And essentially, I mean, really to put in a few words, it means that with higher demand, we have higher fees, and with lower demand, we have lower fees. Many people in the space here probably know this as Harburger taxes or land value tax, but the idea really is that you will only buy this kind of domain if you're willing to like use the domain for some productive use, because otherwise you're most likely not gonna afford the fees essentially. We can compare the different pricing models. So I'll start with land value tax and then we'll move into Harburger tax just to understand basically what makes them different. And basically land value tax is really an idea that comes from pricing real estate, and essentially it would work by assessing a property's value and then constantly like taxing based on the property's value, like a continuous tax. And the valuation of the property would be done somehow through a government, market, or an index. And what is kind of important to understand when comparing against Harburger tax is that the owner still controls the sales timing, so they can always decline the sale or just wait or whatever. And however, the problem with it is that it is like subject to gaming. So there can be corruption. You could potentially corrupt the assessor and try to get like a much lower absolute taxation. Whereas the Harburger tax kind of decentralizes the aspect of assessment by saying the owner always has to self-assess the property, but then the owner cannot control the sales timing anymore. The property can always be bought from the owner at the current self-assessed price. And so that kind of removes this vector of corruption where we can just bribe, for example, the assessor of the property. Why does this work? Harburger taxes, why do they work? Why do they create great prices? It is because, and here you can see on the vertical axis the cost and the risk of a forced sale, and on the vertical axis you can see the self-assessed price. If you self-assess your property at a very high price, you will pay a lot of taxes, but you will have a low risk of a forced sale. Whereas if you price your property at a very low cost, you will pay a low amount of taxes, but you will have a very high risk of a forced sale. So every owner in that system essentially has an incentive by themselves to find an optimal balance of where they want to put the risk of a forced sale and the tax costs that they're paying. And this is why Harburger taxes work. How can we actually build this in smart contracts? So I called this presentation demand-based reoccurring fees in practice. So here's the practice. Essentially, it's a model called deprecating licenses, where some collateral is being sent into a smart contract. So this could be ETH, and we call this collateral here, that's the letter C, essentially. And there's a price function PT, where T is the time that passes, and essentially the collateral decays over time throughout a period that we denote with big T. And so in the charts on the right, you can see this T being 30 days, so like a month. And on the top chart, you can essentially see that at P0, the price of the license is essentially all the collateral. And then at P15, it has essentially decayed by half, because 15 days is the half of the entire period, which is 30 days. And so the demand-based reoccurring fee aspect here comes from the fact that people have to rebid with their collateral. So these spikes that you're seeing, where there's the where there's this error saying bid was made, where it just like vertically jumps up, this is when a new person inserts their collateral, and then the decay starts again at the collateral value that they've put in, and at T equaling zero, basically. What's also important to mention is essentially that the higher you set the collateral, the more collateral you absolutely pay over a time period. And this can be seen in the lower right chart, where there was one owner that set a very high amount of collateral, and so the steepness of the depreciation is actually much higher than the second person that then bid it and set kind of a lower amount of collateral. And as you can see, these periods on the lower chart, they're essentially the same length, but the first person is paying a significant higher amount of collateral per time, essentially. We can also see this when we look at Desmos and we essentially just drag the collateral slider. You can see that essentially with more collateral, the steepness of the depreciation essentially increases. That's it. That's demand-based reoccurring fees in practice. I wanted to keep this very educational, so, and I hope you learned something today. Thank you.
Wow, really nice talk, and actually something that I, as I mentioned before, I'm extremely interested in. So I put a few questions in here, but the first one isn't from me. Again, let's read it out for the audience. Let's say you buy a domain for your startup and set the price for 10K. Does it mean that if your competitor with deep pockets wants to buy your domain, you'd be forced to sell it for 10K?
In the Harburger text model, yes, you would be forced to sell the domain at 10K. However, your deep-pocketed competitor would have to continuously pay a tax every month set at the 10K price, which would make it very costly for them to keep up paying that price. So your competitor may also, you know, your competitor may also buy like a domain in the traditional pricing model, and then they would have to just pay like $21.99 a year. So yeah. I think it's still an improvement. Got it.
So how should we think about Harbinger when some players have a high risk or fear to force selling versus those with lower risk or lower fear of selling, like homeowners versus investment companies?
Yeah. So it's not always ideal to use Harburger taxes in all types of property classes. So I think real estate, you want to have a higher stability in real estate specifically. But for example, you could also price online ads with Harburger tax, and then the ownership transition between online ads, there's actually no harm done in the ownership changing. Like I think as users, we probably even like ads to change on a website. And then for, I think, domain names, it's also a nuanced discussion. I think if you have if you would price uniswap.com with Harburger taxes, and they could be like forced sales that are instant, I think this would most likely lead to security attacks and so on. So you would have to have some kind of time delay function, let's say, where you can announce a change or whatever. But so it really depends. I think it depends on the property, and there are better cases and worse cases to apply it.
Got it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so this one was from me, and maybe I'm not sure if this is relevant to the research you've been doing, but there's a lot of talk these days about allocative efficiency for choosing proposers. We're talking about maybe a tester proposer separation. So could we use Harbinger tax for choosing proposers on Ethereum? And are there any risks to doing something like this?
Yeah. I'm not super deep into like the proposer. I don't know much about it, but I would say that if you're auctioning off block space, I'm pretty sure this could work, where you have to pay a continuous tax for you to be granted the license to create the next block, I would imagine that this would be pretty interesting. I can't think off the top of my head what this would do, but I always tend to think that Harbinger taxes and land value tax actually, contrarily to what people think, they actually lower prices, because if you're a holder that has a monopoly on a non-fungible good like real estate, for example, you're really not in a rush to sell this property. You can, as we saw in my first slide with the vacant lot, I might wait 10 years for the price to go up from, you know, $3,600 to $6,000. So actually, if we could apply Harbinger taxes or land value tax without these problematic issues of, you know, a forced sale happening immediately, I think we would actually see real estate prices and rent prices probably drop, because there would be a higher rate of utilization in cities, and people would generally just use or rent properties when they need them, right? And at the moment, I think there's just no cost for leaving them vacant. I don't know, maybe that makes sense for you on a proposal level.
Definitely. No, it does. I think we should have this conversation later. Nice. And then maybe last question. So again, maybe related to a previous question, how do average users think about Harbinger tax?
Yeah, I think we have to do a lot of work in terms of UX, just like maybe not even specifically explaining or telling people that this is Harbinger tax, more like work with the words that DeFi uses, like collateral, or fees. I think tax is kind of a tricky word with crypto people, I think. So, I don't know. I think there's...
Thank you for listening. Be sure to visit archive.devcon.org to watch and listen to all the other DevCon talks. We look forward to seeing you next time.